Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm your co-host, Paul David.
And I'm William Gadsby-Pete. We're not being joined by Rebecca today as she's out celebrating her birthday, currently tearing it up in Croydon. So if you want to give her a special birthday present, please make sure to like, subscribe, review this episode so when she comes back, she can see all those metrics moving up and to the right.
Happy birthday, Rebecca.
Happy birthday, Rebecca.
So today's episode, we're going to be taking a look at a very hot topic, controversial question that everyone seems to be asking, and that is, will AI take our jobs and our livelihoods? Over the last few years, we've seen a real increase in prominence of AI and how it's affecting the workforce in every industry. So we're going to dig into that today.
And try and, you know, really get beneath a lot of the hype. I think a lot of, with AI, you see a lot of, you know, shit in the press about people that don't really understand it, and there's a lot of fear mongering. So really trying to give you the actual reality of the situation. So we're going to kind of break down the current state of AI, its threat or lack thereof to the jobs market, look at some of the industries that are actually most affected and are going to be the most affected, have the conversation around augmentation versus automation, then look at some of the darker side of things, the issues around bias and misuse, and then finishing the pod off today with some advice on how to prepare for the future, both as an individual or as an organization, how you can prepare for an AI future, which, you know, whether we like it or not, is coming down the pike.
I feel like there's a lot of yet in the conversation, like it's not going to replace us yet, it's not going to take our jobs yet and things like that. But I think I'm hopeful there's a lot more augmentation than automation, or, you know, sort of replacement, I guess. So yeah, let's dig into it.
Awesome. So yeah, I mean, to kick us off, we're going to look at the actual foundation of this question. Ultimately, the fear is that AI will replace jobs in a way that doesn't really result in more being created. There's a number of consultants and big firms have released papers on this. A lot of them are saying X hundred million jobs will be replaced by AI by 2030. You know, I've read numbers from 300 million by Goldman Sachs up to 800 million by McKinsey. But then where there's a lot of divergence is, okay, cool, so that's how many jobs it's going to replace. How many new jobs are it's going to bring into the market? Everyone thought that the advent of the steam engine would change all working, and it just meant that we went from an agrarian society to an industrial society. And so, you know, that's kind of the big debate. And I think probably for the first time there's real substance behind the sort of like, actually, does this replace jobs that it takes away? And I think that's the unique fear that people are really worried about. It does feel like there are jobs that AI takes away that it does not replace.
Yeah, you see it in the polling out there. Sky News did a report where they looked at data and they showed that a quarter of all workers are afraid that they're going to be replaced by AI. And so, like, I think it's important to just like contextualize who and what sectors are most at risk and what specific roles. We're often talking about a lot of administrative roles, which we'll dig into a little bit, that are going to be, if not replaced, evolved, I would say. And we're seeing it too on our end in terms of running an agency and using things like ChatGPT for research and writing and things like that. It's a bit scary as a manager leader, because you sort of slowly realize how AI creeps in, and you start to kind of see how your content strategist gets a boost, your writer gets a boost. Ultimately, that means you're potentially hiring fewer of those folks. Mm. But the nature of those folks' role shifts as well. So, you know, eventually you'll need other roles that AI probably will create, in terms of like prompt engineers and people who can sort of leverage AI in interesting ways to move your business forward.
Yeah, I think that's the bit that I think about, and I kind of think personally, and you know, this is based on nothing more than just my opinion, so please don't take it as gospel. I do think that's where we'll end up, whereas it's not a case of replace, it's a case of, okay, well, this digital marketer is now three times more efficient, which means you only need one of them. And then I think there'll be a really interesting question of what does that then do to the market? Tech sector has been understaffed for as long as it's existed. Does that suddenly fill the tech sector gap? Does it actually reverse things and suddenly there's too much supply and not enough demand? What does it mean in the world where one person can create 40 bits of quality content a month to the world of content marketing? These are all open questions that I don't think we'll know the answer to, but does seem like they're gonna, the next 5 years, we're gonna get pretty hard answers on.
Yeah, and I think it's like important to dig into specific sectors. Like there's this piece from the BBC where they interviewed a number of professionals across different industries, and there's a PR worker named Claire who, you know, basically said that, and to quote, "I don't think the quality of the work that I'm producing could be matched by a machine just yet. But at the same time, I'm amazed at how quickly ChatGPT has become so sophisticated." And she, you know, goes on to say that, like, give it a few more years, and she's worried that a bot could essentially, you know, do the job that she's doing right now. And you know, that brings real worries about employability. I think there's real fears there, and then there's real anxiety, but also there's a shift in the nature of those jobs, which I think is actually a more interesting part of the conversation.
But yeah, that quote really stood out for me as well, because I think, to your point, it really summarizes where a lot of the market thinks, which is like, it can't do my job yet. And the truth is, it can't do Claire's job right now, but we work with a consultant on AI that actually very much could, with clever use of spreadsheets, ChatGPT, and some other tools, get to a point where Claire is essentially having 50 emails written and put into her draft folder to then go through and edit lightly. You know, like they're probably about 70% of the way there, have taken personal contact information and customizable language that makes the email sound like it's from a human being, but then implemented that at scale. It could not replace her, but it could get her to the point where she could do two of her colleagues' jobs in terms of output. And that's right now. And that's not widely available. It's not as easy to use a ChatGPT. You do need a bit of a specialist who understands it, but those tools are going to become more and more common. The reason that you see this AI arms race where every industry or every software tool that you've used is suddenly releasing AI is because actually it's not that difficult. Like the difficulty of interfacing with ChatGPT and using the foundation that it's built and then developing specific use cases for your industry is far, far easier than what these companies were previously doing, which was building this stuff from scratch themselves. It is just speaks to the volume and scale and the speed of how things are moving. If I'm the product developer at Notion, I understand ChatGPT and how Notion could interface with it, and I can release Notion AI in like, you know, a 2-month cycle, whereas building that myself from scratch would probably take 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. I think it's important too, like we don't want to downplay the anxiety that's out there, but also we want people to kind of feel empowered to learn how to integrate AI into their practice, but also acknowledge that there are going to be some shifts, there are going to be some changes to the nature of their roles, just like, yeah, the general scope of the work that they're doing. And I think that, like, it's almost like an adaptive, almost like emotional shift for people to be like, okay, you know, I don't need to do as much busy work anymore. I don't need to, like, you know, appear busy, or, you know, this like presenteeism and things like that in the workplace. It's like, okay, this work can be shifted to AI, and now I get to focus on deeper, more thought intensive tasks and things like that. You know, we just did an episode about education and in tech, but like, I think that's going to be the more interesting shift of like, how do you move people who are used to maybe doing more sort of like menial basic tasks upstream and like upskill them, get them trained. You know, I think you talk to a lot of career coaches and HR professionals. I think that's going to be where the work is in like people ops and HR, and sort of like, what does it mean to take a workforce and upskill them and grow them and integrate AI into the work that we're doing? We're already seeing a little bit ourselves, as you mentioned, working with Dale and bringing in someone who has expertise around that and kind of trying to integrate it into our team. But I think the thing that I worry about is like, we have this huge piece of game-changing tech that changes the rules for everyone. And, you know, obviously AI is going to be the main focus for the next decade. But sort of how is it integrated, at what pace, how do we sort of upskill people and get them ready? I think that to me is like just the most fascinating part of what's happening right now.
Yeah, and to sort of end this section on a positive note, I actually think probably of all the industries used to this speed of change, digital marketers is one of them, because yeah. Like, yes, Instagram is the same platform at its heart, but the specifics of what works on it change literally every week. So yeah, I do feel that like there are a lot of industries that have shown they can adapt with like, okay, we have this foundation of AI, and now that every week something new comes from it. I think the only stuff I worry about is for industries that are not used to that speed of change. I think they're the ones who are going to struggle the most. Cool. So we've kind of given a bit of an overview and of like the landscape now, but yeah, I wanted to sort of move into some of the real impact of AI and like the specific examples that we're seeing, kind of both good and bad. So I think probably the most prominent one that's happening right now that's, I would say, is very much AI in the negative is the Hollywood writers and actors strike, where we're seeing a corporation try and put down some pretty insane things that would gut an industry. When you look into the thing they're striking over, it's like, yeah, totally fair play to them. I hope they absolutely win that battle. It's essentially saying that, like, okay, as an extra, you come for a single day of filming where we just film you in a 360-degree bunch of shots on a green screen, and then we'll just edit you in via CGI to scenes. Similar stuff even for, like, major Hollywood talent, where it's like, oh, all those days you'd film where you're a stunt person or we just needed the back of your head, you're now not in those scenes, you're not getting paid for them, we'll just put you in via AI, and a bunch of other stuff around writers and, you know, credit and like just how fucked the industry is right now because of the sort of lasting ramifications of Netflix and Amazon and other streaming services. So that, I would say that's very much a sort of mark of the of bad, where it's like, here is a profession and we are actively trying to get rid of the people that are this profession as much as possible to make it more cost effective for Hollywood studios to make films. So yeah, I'd put that in the bad.
Yeah, and I'm going to preface this by saying this is completely not me playing devil's advocate for the studios or whatever, but I'm just like, when that came up, I was curious about how is the AI sort of generated images being repurposed and used and stuff like that, like from a legal perspective, just wondering how that's different from, okay, you make a film with a studio and the studio gets to kind of like reproduce that film and you've signed on to a certain amount of salary or fees or royalties or something like that. I was just curious, like, that to me seems like an extension of that contract, you know what I mean? So I could, like, in that sense, again, I'm not, no way siding with the studio here, but like just from a legal perspective, and I think this is an interesting broader question of like, how's the legal profession keeping pace with the speed of change that's happening? Because that seems like here's a new element of a contract that like completely blew up in the news and like completely obviously caused the strike. But like, I can see from the studio's perspective, we're like, well, yeah, this is just, we're using another tool just like we would film to like reproduce your image. But it's obviously wrong. Like, it's obviously terrible and it's taking away sort of money off of people's tables and stuff like that. But like, I'm just curious how the legal profession is like keeping pace with that and dealing with it and how they work that out, you know, how they distinguish, like, we're creating an image based on AI and reusing it over and over again versus we filmed you in a bunch of different situations and we're reusing that. I don't know.
No, totally. And I do think that from what's come out in the press is there's no nuance. It's just, yeah, we film you for one day, you get paid for one day of filming and then you're gone. And like that's clearly bullshit. But like, hey, we do that process, but then for every amount of times that scene's used or whatever, like
royalties,
then there's some form of percentage fee that we can all agree on.
Yeah.
And I think that's just the only way they'll get there. And as well, to play devil's advocate, obviously this has been focused on Hollywood, massive writers, massive productions, but making films is really fucking expensive. And if you could make, you know, if people are signing up with, yeah, I'm fine to just do a day of filming and you then have my permission to use it in AI, it does potentially make it more accessible for filmmakers from more independent studios. Like, it does make the art form potentially more accessible. So there is some benefits if it's done responsibly. And I think what's come out in the press is like, obviously this was corporate greed and absolutely not being done responsibly, but it's not going to be the case of we only do in-film person. I think it'll have to be some compromises. They just have to find a way to compensate actors and writers and everyone accordingly, that it isn't just the only people making money off of film with the studios and everyone else can go fuck themselves. Like, obviously that can't be the case.
Yeah, I'm also wondering too about, like, obviously we've seen the writing abilities, quote unquote, of ChatGPT and things like that, and how much, I haven't heard much about that in the debate, like how much they're actually using AI. Like, I used ChatGPT the other day. I had like a story idea and I was like, hey, write me a short story based on this like novel concept that I had. And it did, you know, an interesting job, and it actually bored out a little bit. But like, how much are they starting to just use it to replace writers entirely and just like have it write scripts or have it write, you know, storyboards or something like that? Like, that is interesting because that's a totally different thing. You know, that's just like, how do we automate people entirely out of their jobs and use AI as like an engine for creativity, which I think is like, it doesn't seem like it's quite there yet, but the possibility is there and you're already seeing the seeds of change there. So I think that's another interesting angle of like, you know, what right do you have to a job that has now been automated out? You know what I mean? Like, it's one thing to say like, hey, this is my job and you're overusing my image and things like that for, you know, beyond the rights that I've agreed to and things like that. You're replacing me after I've done a little bit of work. It's another thing entirely to say, hey, we don't even need you. You've been displaced, you know? So like, where does the agency of the studios and the businesses end in that sense? And like, how are they limited in their ability to use the tools versus, you know, people's entitlement to work? I think it's an interesting question.
No, totally. And I mean, like, in this as well, like, as with always with these things, folk like us will do a lot of hand-wringing and then some studio just go, fuck you, and do it. And then we just all have to live with the new normal of like, okay, well, they managed to make Fast and the Furious 403 for like a fraction of the cost. And now every studio is doing that. And the money is going to ensure that the legal battle gets won on the side of Greece. Yeah. Let's now, on the uplifting side, maybe look at a very much a use of AI for good. And this is in the case of drug development. This is really just nothing but good news. Basically, there are a bunch of drug development companies that are using AI. And this process to develop a drug through clinical trials to get it to market, like, literally costs $1 billion more quite often.
Yeah.
It's why there's so much money in big pharma. It's why, you know, there's so much sway in many political systems by big pharma. With AI, you can get drugs the market, and companies have successfully got drugs to market in the tens of millions of dollars in comparison. So that's a good thing that I think we can all agree on, that makes the world a better place. Less money for big pharma, more drugs on market at more affordable prices. Those are all big ticks.
Question: who are the workers inside that former process that cost billions that are being displaced, or are their jobs changing? Like, there's got to be a lot of researchers and doctors and stuff like that. And like, I don't know much about that drug development process. I know it's very expensive, but I'm just genuinely curious. Yeah. Like, who are the people inside of that who would otherwise have spent that time and earn that money researching and developing those drugs that are now being replaced? An interesting question. I don't know. I'm curious to hear. So maybe we should have someone on who can speak to that and talk about, because I'd love to hear what the process actually looks and feels like on the AI side of things versus like the traditional process, and kind of side by side compare the two. But
no, yeah, I would love to have someone on. My feeling from it is a lot of the people that made it very expensive have been cut out, and those researchers are still doing all the sequencing, putting all this AI. But this is, again, just wild speculation and based off reading like one or two pieces. It doesn't seem like it's something that's putting out a ton of people out of the industry. It's just quite an inefficient, bloated process that AI has massively sped up. That's on the plus side. And this is constant push and pull between like, where will the impact lie? We were talking about the kind of revolutions that happen faster and faster in tech. People had just got used to the internet, then social media popped up, you know, completely changed how pretty much every brand existed and spoke to its audience. Downsides: massively polarized our society, got everyone in, you know, slightly addicted to viral loops, just gutted newspapers and the publishing industry, and replaced it with basically an unregulated version of that. On the plus side, gave people communities they'd never had before, gave brands an ability to advertise and carve a gap out in the market without needing VC money or funding, gave content creators and artists an outlet to build an audience. Like, it's one of those things where it's only about 10 years after the dust settled that you can really look back retrospectively and go, oh, fuck, big shifts in our society happened because of this. And I do think we'll see the same in AI, where it's like, okay, would we be willing to put out a significant amount of the research and pharmaceutical industry if it meant that the whole of society gets access to cheap drugs that are on the market quicker and can sort of outpace the scary speed at which viruses become drug resistant? Yes, I think we'd all take that trade-off. And I think there'll be lots of those things where we don't really know the true ramifications and impact until years down the line.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue of, I'm curious too with the drug research and just any medical related research about the issue of bias and how like a lot of these language learning models are just, you know, very complex if A, then Y decision trees, which means they've been trained on a specific, you know, data set or data sets. And whoever chooses those data sets essentially determines the biases and outputs of that model, which is a bit concerning given what we've seen, you know, that already exists in, you know, what are they called? The oximeters that have bias against folks who have darker skin, things like that. You know, we see a lot of bias against women in clinical research and things like that. Things just being tested on men, for example. And we've seen, like, obviously the horrible racist and sexist chatbots that were trained on social media data. How can we get AI to a point with like better data sets, or is there some sort of unbiased function we can insert into AI? I think that's really interesting. And I think there's a lot of researchers working on it. Timit Gebru, formerly of Google, is one that comes to mind. We were just at an AI event last week at King's College. And one of the questions I put to them was sort of, who are the voices out there who are talking about adaptation and mitigation? And the panel didn't really have a good answer. Like, they mentioned Timnit, they mentioned a few other people, but there weren't entities like, you know, charities, nonprofits, or even government institutions that were like, okay, we see this coming and we're working on some form of mitigation where it's helping people upskill or reskill, helping people, you know, save jobs or at least be compensated in some way for this. So I think like tackling the issue of mitigation, tackling the issues of bias are pretty critical when it comes to like, how do we get this right? Which I think is a more interesting question, sort of the fear mongering and the sort of like, oh my God, this is coming, we should just prepare, it's going to all take our jobs. But like, how. Like that to me is the juicy bit to dive into, I think.
Yeah, I think that piece on bias is so key. Like we work with a client called Equity in the Center who are there trying to solve racial inequality in the States. The obvious examples of like social media bias, where it's like this person saying racist shit or saying sexist shit, that they're easy to call out. It's unconscious bias that is so dangerous. It's the white woman who thinks I'm an ally but actually isn't. And so when that, you know, woman or her team build a AI algorithm to approve funding applications, loans, to profile people at an airport on who looks shifty, like shit like that, the real world applications that are happening in Silicon Valley and governments, it's those unconscious biases that get put in, and suddenly you have a, you know, a loan system that will just not approve applications for black folk in America because this person thinks that their credit rating isn't good enough, and like it's shit like that that's really scary.
You kind of want to reach for, and I wish, you know, there were more examples out there of like, hey, here's an example of a lab that has sort of trained their generative AI to sort of not do that, or to come up with better answers, or they're just inputting better data sets or something like that. I feel like that's needed right now. I'm just hungry for more positive kind of, okay, we fix this, we unbias this, we are dealing with the privacy issues, which is another thing to talk about too, is you know, like ChatGPT being free to use because it's learning and refining its LLM off of user data. So visual tools like Midjourney and DALL-E, there's a lot of uproar in the design community about these tools being trained, you know, on large batches of images without permission from artists that will receive no compensation for their work. You know, we work with a lot of designers, and there's hesitance and a bit of concern about how will the job of designers change? Will designers be, you know, pushed out of their jobs, or will it be kind of another tool like Adobe that they just integrate into their practice and they figure out how to use fluidly and be able to augment their work and kind of expand it? So, yeah, I think between like raising up some of those more positive stories and then addressing some of these privacy issues, that those are kind of the roads we want to head down with the AI conversation.
On the more positive side of things, like ChatGPT is the example of the one they managed to get bias out of, like that, you know, that's the one they launched because they finally fucking found a data set to train it on that didn't, and even then, like, that put it that with a massive pinch of salt of that we know of yet. People have shown of it saying stuff to them, but you know, it tends to be more just weird rather than like institutionally biased
hallucinations.
Yeah, it seems more like just whatever. Who gave a ChatGPT some shrooms?
Yeah.
The final point I wanted to kind of talk about real world examples and this kind of automation versus augmentation debate is administrative and low skill tasks. That's actually something I really worry about in terms of the stuff that AI can already absolutely automate rather than augment is really low skill administrative tasks, data entry, you know, crappy spreadsheet analysis, updates, that kind of thing. One of the fears I have of AI is, yeah, you have to adapt, you have to upskill, you have to constantly train, but like you have to be so clued up, technologically literate, and part of probably a more affluent, educated demographic to really understand this and have access to these tools. You know, we spoke about on the last podcast about education. You know, you can't assume edtech can solve everyone's problems because most households in the UK don't have access to the fucking internet and a laptop. So, you know, if you then bring AI into the conversation, I do worry that it maybe makes our society even more unequal because you have all of these people that have these high-paying jobs in high, fast-paced tech environments around AI, programming, data science. And then all of these previous jobs around office admin, project management, that still pay pretty well, like suddenly disappear and they're replaced. And there isn't any real effort to offer those team members alternatives or upskill them. It's just, okay, cool, we don't need a project manager anymore, we've automated our Asana board, we're like, goodbye.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's trying not to always veer towards the negative here, but I think we can probably agree that it's going to get worse before it gets better, and that like we're going to see this shift and sort of a culling of a lot of these administrative jobs, unfortunately, until we figure out a way to, again, like lean more towards augmentation, lean more towards integration. So do you then have like a project manager who can use AI for some of the administrative tasks, but then they are able to then handle more complex projects than they were previously? I think that's really interesting. I think hopefully a lot of companies are figuring out how to maintain their workforce for the most part. Like, I know on our end, we're not like, oh, we have ChatGPT now, so we're instantly going to get rid of writers and content strategists. Like, obviously, that's not our disposition. And I'm hopeful that's not the disposition of many other business owners. But unfortunately, some will, large corporations will, and things like that. But yeah, I think that's a real concern around administrative tasks.
From our actual AI coach, we work with a guy called Dale Bertrand over at Fire and Spark. He's very, very, very smart. And him and his team have been experimenting a lot with these tools. And one of the things that he sort of taught us about is he has an integration with ChatGPT in his sales CRM, where at the start of each month, ChatGPT just looks at all of the sort of like conversations that are in the CRM from 2 months ago that haven't had any engagement or movement, looks at the notes from the calls that are in the CRM and personalizes sort of like between 5 to 20 emails, depending on how much activity was going that month, puts them into Dale's email outbox as a draft. And he goes through, makes sort of 5-10 seconds of edits on each one and then hits send. He was like, we used to do this manually, one of our team members. We all hated it. We'd take turns of who did it. It was a shit job. No one liked it. I've now completely automated the process, and that person can get involved far more with client management and strategy work. So, you know, I think that's one example of how it's done right is like, yes, we're removing this job, but it's not then, okay, well, now we don't need this person. It's okay, cool. Let's, what can we move them on to? What can we get them involved with that's more valuable to them and the agency?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, Lord knows we could use that support on the sales side in terms of the work that we do. But yeah, I think like taking you 80% of the way there and then you sort of augment with personalization and sort of the human touch, I think is like, that's a sweet spot. Now that salesperson's job is a lot more interesting because they can do some deeper research on the client, because I think there's so much room for like, how does AI move us to greater personalization at scale? And if AI can do that, ChatGPT can put that email in your outbox, then great, I can spend more time really digging deep and like researching this client and saying, okay, where do they go to school? What things are they interested in? Oh, they love dogs, so I can talk about dogs. I can dig into their background and like shout out a place they used to work before, really understand them on a human level. I think that is some of the most interesting terrain of how does it turn us more towards each other and away from, okay, I need to like move these files around and things like that. That I think is going to be one of the more important and fascinating parts of the adaptation process.
To that point, the scary part of AI is also the exciting part, is like actually if it's done well and responsibly, it could free up so much of like the human creative spirit to just focus on the shit that is the most needed and the most enriching, both personally and professionally. So yeah, fingers crossed we nail it.
Yeah, just one quick note about the data, some of the data we looked at about the different waves of AI and things like that. I thought it was interesting that transport was called out as like one of the highest potential risk of automation, or one of the industries I should say that has the highest potential risk of automation. And you're already seeing, obviously, in the UK, you know, massive strikes from rail workers and transportation workers, and to see that coming, it makes you wonder sort of what's evolving in the contracts that they're now negotiating and signing as it comes to AI. I could imagine train systems that are entirely run by AI, or you know, buses potentially once we get to self-driving car land, which I feel like has been promised for a really long time but hasn't come yet. And then yeah, financial services were called out. Health was another sector that was called out as well, I think is really interesting. But yeah, transport I think is a really interesting one, because it is such a sort of like manual labor intensive, very industrial profession right now. And if that to me feels like a massive shift in the other direction of like, okay, AI is making sure the trains run on time and that the buses are well oiled or fixed or whatever. So yeah, I think that's gonna be an interesting one.
Yeah, I think that transport one is particularly interesting for the US, like the top paid median job that's the most common in almost every state of America is truck driver, because it's like it's a good paying job for many folk, like where at least it used to be. That is sort of an industry that like has millions of people in it that could probably already be replaced by trucks that drive themselves that are more safe than human drivers. But you can't do that, because the one time that a truck crash is driven by AI, it doesn't matter that 5 humans would have crashed in the same time period. The news headlines will go, robots killed, you know, these people. There are, again, just to give some sort of idea of the seismic shifts that these that could be happening, it's like, okay, one of the most well-paid, most sort of highly sought after and populated jobs in America could, in the space of a year, be replaced entirely automated, not augmented, completely automated. How do we then deal with those people? How do we integrate them back into society, into different jobs? How do we offer them an off-ramp to something else?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Sort of, I hesitate to call it a double standard because it's not quite that, but like sort of the distinction of like, hey, here's a mistake that humans make on the daily, you know what I mean? And then as soon as a computer, AI, or like one robot crashes, and then it's like, okay, well, we got to like throw everything out, baby in the bathwater. I find that really interesting. And I think it just speaks to like the phase of transition that we're in, where people are nervous about it. And obviously, like, we're sort of walking on eggshells into this new era. But yeah, I wonder like what's going to make us, help us get over that hump. I think that's where government and business and, you know, the charity sector need to come together. The best way to sort of predict the future is to just make it, you know. Mm. And so like how are they going to come together and do that and say like, look, this is going to be safer for people, you know, humans, like if we don't have tired truck drivers driving, you know, through the night.
I do actually think that will be the biggest blocker to AI, is that ultimately these tech products get developed and then you have to put them in front of a room full of like 50-year-old white dudes and be like, hey, do you, and there's just an instinctive distrust of anything robot-y or AI. So like, I think that's actually probably the biggest blocker for the adoption of these technologies in stuff like transport and systems, is you probably have like the transport minister for the UK just going, nah, I don't like the look of this. This seems like weird and scary. Well, we wanted to end on a positive note, and obviously we've covered a lot of scary stuff. So in the closing section here, we're just going to kind of look at how can companies and individuals actually prepare themselves for AI? What can they do to make sure that they transition successfully and this isn't something that replaces them but augments them? I think one of the things I think needs to happen almost before getting into like granular specifics is, as an employer and as an individual, you and your team kind of need to accept that like AI is, there is now just this constant need for upskilling and learning. Like that's always been there to some extent in every profession, in tech in particular, but it's now reached fever pitch, and that sucks, but it just is what it is. The pace at which AI moves is days and weeks. It is not months or years. So there's almost wrapping your head around that, and probably most importantly, getting your learning and development and your HR team to wrap their head around that, because that is not the pace they're used to or enjoy. It sucks. Like there's no getting around that. So I think that's probably the first sort of big meta point. A lot of what you knew even about the tech industry that was already very fast paced is out the window. And as well, you kind of just need this open-mindedness to like what is and isn't replaceable or augmentable. If you were to give a kid advice 5 years ago about what's an industry they could be guaranteed is going to be really well stocked and going to give them a career forever and be really high in demand and really well paid, you'd have told them to learn how to code. It's very much looking like AI will be able to do most coding. Like, and like, don't get me wrong, you still need a master software engineer to check it and get rid of any of the bugs, but coding is a logic-based sort of form. It's a science, it's not an art. So there are very hard rules of if A, then Y, which is what an LLM loves. So like, it's just that sort of thing where it's like, okay, well, I if coding is now no longer a surefire career in tech, that just gives you the idea of the scale and the flexibility you have to have as a mind and as a company and as a HR department in terms of L&D before we jump into the specifics and the granular stuff.
Yeah, I think that's where we're going to see the greatest changes, like in, as you mentioned, like HR and people ops departments, of kind of like, how do we fuse like human AI collaboration into every job that we're doing, every skill level throughout the organization?
Yeah, 100%. I think the last sort of meta point before jumping into the specifics, I would encourage everyone listening to this podcast and everyone who just generally in society, like, be that person in the room that goes, okay, we could do this, but should we? To quote the wonderful Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park. Yeah, just make sure someone is always asking that question of, are we the bad guys? Could this suck? We've spoken a lot about the positive and negative applications, but you know, there are some people out there that can do some very bad things with AI. So let's make sure that none of us are them when we're building products, building content, you know, whatever we're doing with it. Just you know, be that person in the room that goes, guys, let's just have a chat about the ethical angle before we get into the practical angle?
Yeah, I think the AI event I went to last week, there was just a lot of talk of ethics. And when I asked the question about who are the folks focused on mitigation, who are the voices that people should be listening to, the panelists basically said, listen to the ethicists, like talk to the ethicists, you know, understand where they're coming from, understand the people who are really trying to like shape the conversation. And I think like would love to get an AI ethicist on the pod at some point to talk about this. But yeah, I think that is like kind of where the most interesting conversations are happening in terms of like, should we, how should we, in what ways? I think that's, yeah, that's where we need to take the conversation.
Cool. We're just going to round off with some strategies and advice for any company or person who's looking to get involved in AI and sort of not be replaced with it. And before jumping into that, I think it's worth noting like, the companies that are adopting AI are reporting like, you know, 35% improvement in innovation, 33% improvement in sustainability per the Taku 2023 report. So, you know, there is opportunities and benefits there. And like you said, you know, if you're doing it ethically and you're not just replacing people and kind of being driven by a fuck you profit motive, I think you really can actually harness AI in a way that just benefits everyone. So the first things first, and I know this sounds almost like a no shit Sherlock, but your company needs an AI policy and an upskill plan fucking yesterday. So get on that and get whoever, like, I mean, I would probably actually task this as something that your kind of CEO needs to look at. It's that important, but like there are a number of tools out there. There's a great website called There's an AI for That, a good old-fashioned Google. You could even use Bard as an AI to find out about more AI. But if you essentially put in task X AI to solve this, there is something out there. Copywriting, design, video, HR platforms, meeting notes, summaries, like build, looking at like, and you know, you already probably have an org chart with what every one of your teams do, but putting together a team-wide plan of like, okay, here's my design team. What are the 20 most popular AI design tools on the market right now? Okay, I think 3 of these are applicable to this team. Let's get them onto their HR training. Let's, you know, add them to a list and build a strategy where we have AI in every specific department and then company-wide to help with a lot of those admin and organizational tasks that we've already spoken about.
Yeah, I think it's important to be conscious about the conversation that needs to happen as the rollout of AI occurs within your company or just like in society in general. You're going to see different teams, you know, more or less anxious, more or less resistant to how they integrate the tools. We had to write an AI strategy ourselves, and one of the things we did was list out the different departments and the different tools and things like that, and just like offer it to people. I think giving people choice is really helpful, and get saying here's a couple different tools that you could use to enhance your practice, presenting it as a tool for augmentation and not complete automation and replacement, I think is really important. I think having it come from leadership, having C-suite kind of lead on this and make sure that they understand the tools and the applications more than anyone else in the team, and that they're walking people through what's like a difficult change management process of, okay, look, you know, your job, your role is going to change. I think that too is like, okay, you've been hired for this role, you've had a specific job description, and you know, initially you're meant to do this, but now the ground has shifted underneath you. So again, back to people ops and HR, like how do we sort of have that conversation with people of like, okay, designer X, like you now need to integrate Midjourney into, you know, your process or DALL-E or whatever. And in process, shift people's jobs, I think is really important. And then also just like being transparent with that plan. So like, you know, write the plan and then, you know, walk your team through it and you know, really talk about their worries, give reassurance where it's, you know, where it's needed, but also dig into the nitty-gritty of like, okay, this is specifically how I think your job as a designer, your job as a writer, your job as a content strategist can and should change. Do we agree? How do we move forward? And just like, you know, hold people's hand a little bit through the change, because it is really difficult.
Yeah, I think that transparency element is so key. Like we spoke about it at the start, but you know, a quarter of all survey respondents are saying they're fearful of getting replaced by AI. You have to address that. Like that's 1 in 4 of your employees. And that's probably every month getting worse as more people read these headlines and see. So yeah, once you've created that plan, sharing it with the team and offering them constant comms on it, I think is absolutely vital. The other key thing I think is when you do find moments of, okay, actually, I probably could automate this role entirely. Like, you know, there's that augmentation role of like communicating with your team of like, okay, here's the ground shifting underneath you. And now I want you to upskill on these new plans. And we've got a bespoke plan from HR for you on how you're going to use learning and development tools to get there. In the cases where you have just got jobs that are like totally obsolete now and completely handled by AI, if you have a good person, don't throw them away. Like with the role, they can train on new things, like give them an opportunity to stay. If they were a brilliant project manager, they're probably going to be a brilliant something else. So don't just throw them out because their role's been fully automated in the cases where that will happen, because it will. And again, just something I'd love to see is like an ethical practice that we almost see people getting called out on as the way they are about carbon footprint. It's like, okay, you've automated these roles, you've increased efficiency. How have you kept your human team and matched their new output with new resources and new demand and new roles, rather than just going, okay, well, we don't need project managers anymore, so we fired 20 people?
Yeah, I think also bringing in outside support is really critical. That's what's been so powerful about bringing in Dale and the Fire and Spark team, is like having your team recognize that you've invested in outside coaching and advice and someone who's like done the work with AI specifically to understand the tools really deeply, who has an understanding of how they can be integrated into your team's practice. It feels like you're investing in your team rather than trying to replace them or sort of just sneak in automation to kind of take people's jobs away and things like that. I think that outside expertise is important because it gives your team confidence that you're investing in them, you're supporting their work, and you're trying to make their job more intellectually stimulating and interesting, and that you believe in them. You know, you believe that they can change and advance in their role, and you know, you're sort of bringing in that investment to help them grow.
Totally. I think that would probably be my final bit of advice, is like, make it cool. Like, this is the stuff of science fiction, and some of it's scary, but some of it's very, very cool. And the training sessions we've done with Dale, where he like shows and demonstrates a specific output, the whole team is like jaw on the floor, excited and interesting. It like, it can be very cool, and you can make people excited about it.
And it's cool to see people embrace the tools themselves and take ownership. Like, you know, Adi, our content strategist, on, you know, a day he had off, was just like experimenting with a bunch of different tools to help the development of content strategy and keyword research and stuff like that. So like, if you do it right, the team gets excited, they get to play with different tools to, you know, and they get to see and feel how their job is hopefully made better and improved by the integration of AI tools.
If you are sort of CEO or C-suite or the person who's going to be the main decision maker here, like, do make sure you're also asking whether you should, just because you can. There may well be some cases where you look at a department and go, I could get rid of this department here with AI, but should I? And that's really, I'm not going to pretend that's an easy question to ask. Like, you know, we all sat there where you're looking at like, how can I squeeze a bit more margin here, a bit more margin there? But I do think this should be an issue, like your carbon footprint. It's far easier to run a company that is not carbon negative. You don't do it because it makes profit sense. You do it because it makes ethical sense. And so I do think you need to, as you said, always ask with an ethicist, or have that ethicist hat on, along with the what you can do with the tools, what you should do with them.
Yeah, I think it's important to look at models too. I think one example I've read about is the Japanese economy, and how they're a modern, high-performing economy, and they've managed to not have these mass layoffs that we see in the West and things like that. And this is even pre-AI, and they have one of the fastest aging societies, and I think it's the fastest aging society in the world, right? But they don't have these mass firings. They keep people in roles. They reskill them. They find ways to keep their overall unemployment rate like pretty low by comparison. So is there something we can learn from economies like the Japanese economy in terms of how we move forward and integrate AI into our practice? I fear that we won't. I fear it might not happen. But I think looking at models out there and saying, hey, how have they figured out a way to have, you know, massive successful corporations and businesses, but still keep people employed? And because they I think it's, you know, part of their culture and part of their philosophy that like, they're a healthier society if they have fewer people just out of a job, you know, so they will really do the work internally to like limit layoffs and to limit, you know, unemployment and keep people in roles and maybe retrain them and stuff like that. So look at that as an example. I'd love to learn more about it, but that's, you know, some stuff that I've read is in terms of how they manage through change. And they've been, talk about a society that has been through incredible transformation, obviously, since World War II and like, you know, explosion of technology. And Japan's one of the leading technological nations, I'd argue. So yeah, I think there's things to learn from the Japanese economy there.
Well, that's been another exciting episode of Tech Can't Save Us. I hope you came away more informed and enlightened about AI, what it really is and what it really isn't, some strategies and tools and tips for how you might work it into your industry. And yeah, just some excitement that it can be a force for good rather than a force for evil.
Yeah, there's some real opportunities there. I'm glad we could touch on sort of the difficult side, but also the positives and the hopeful bits. As always, thank you all for tuning in today. We really appreciate it. As usual, please like, share, subscribe. I strongly encourage, do it for Rebecca. Happy birthday, Rebecca. And yeah, as always, any thoughts and feedback on today's episode, you can pop us an email at hello@literalhumans.com, and we will catch you next time. Thanks for tuning in.